Welcome to the Expert Approach. My name is Joy Malik, a urology nurse practitioner, and today I would be joined by Dr. Anoop Vora, Clinical Director of Prostate Cancer Focal and Ablative Therapy at Chesapeake Urology, and a well-known nation's foremost urologist making minimally invasive precision-based approaches to prostate cancer. With over 15 years in urology and fellowship trained in urology oncology, Dr. Vora has helped lead adoption of therapies like HIFU and other focal therapies that aim to treat cancer effectively while preserving quality of life. His clinical work, research contribution, and quiet leadership has positioned him as a trusted voice in evolving landscape of prostate cancer management today. So I have the opportunity to deep dive with him on many questions, including focal and ablative therapies. Dr. Vora, welcome.
I appreciate it. You said some kind words there. I don't know if all that's true, but no, it's a pleasure to be on, Joy. Thank you for leading these good discussions, and thank you for being, a pioneer and someone that, everyone can look up to as far as how to approach their career and how to treat patients. So thank you.
So let's start with the focal and ablative therapy and prostate cancer. So, we have seen over the years how much availability of treatment is there for prostate cancer. Sure. Many different approaches, and it's continued to innovate. So it's no longer a one-size-fits-all. So when we talk about focal ablative therapies like HIFU, so how do you do the patient selection? Which patients are the strongest? Which one is less appropriate?
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's a great question. And you're right. We've seen such a transformation over the years with the options that patients have. And that has gone along with almost an inflection point in how patients view healthcare. It went from being a situation where it was whatever you say, doc, I'll do, to now using AI tools to know what their options are and coming in saying, hey, this is what I want. And so as clinicians, we have to just be ready to offer and counsel these patients and kind of guide them into what, we feel may be their best option. Ultimately, it's a shared decision making and patients will decide what's right for them, but we definitely can steer the ship. And, prostate cancer, it went from being very binary, surgery, radiation, there wasn't even surveillance, to then it went to either we watch it or we treat it. And now we have focal therapy, which is an option for those men where maybe the cancer's a little bit too risky for surveillance, but it's not burdensome enough to subject someone to whole gland therapy. So this kind of bridges that gap. And, over the years, we've relied on technology to help us and guide us to this point. I think the first innovation was imaging. With MRIs, we're able to really target and see these areas, these lesions, and biopsy them. And that helps us know that, where the cancer distribution is. And then genomics, we can send these specimens out for genomics, and you have, so many different tests on the market. You have Artera and Decipher and Prolaris and GPS, and all these tests give us some idea of how aggressive the tumor is. And when we have a map of that patient's tumor, I think you said this in your opening statement, it becomes a precision diagnosis where we can individualize that treatment to that patient. And so patients who want focal therapy ideally have image localized prostate cancer. We can see it on the MRI. Their biopsy is congruent to the imaging. So whenever we do a biopsy, it correlates well with the imaging. Low volume, lower risk cancer. And then patient goals is the last thing that we have to look at. You know, there are patients who want focal therapy. They want the advantages with sexual performance and urinary control, but they may not be candidates, and we have to counsel them. Listen, you need a whole gland treatment. But some patients they're great candidates for focal, but you know what? They want peace of mind that their whole prostate's treated, and maybe they're not sexually active, and they don't care about urinary continence as much. So that patient should be steered towards whole gland treatment because that's more in line with their goals. So that's the last aspect that we have to consider is, hey, I can do these fancy things, but is that what the patient wants? Sometimes they don't know what they want. And I have to tell them, well, if you want to focus on your sexual function, maybe this is right for you. If you're not active, maybe it's not right for you. And so, you know, we have to look at the totality of all those different things to decide if someone's a good candidate.
No, that's a great point because I think when people get diagnosed with cancer, everything goes out of the window and their focus is how can I beat the cancer? And the way you framed it, counseling them for the long-term goal is important. But let me probe on that question a little bit more. So, you know, some people are more informed now. And so if they get a targeted treatment, do you get questions like, am I missing something that's left over? What would be the oncology functions? Will I need more retreatment, imaging? How do you counsel those risks?
That's a great point, and often I do not get that from patients. It's almost they have blinders on. This is my lesion, this is my target. And I have to pause and step back and say, what are the risks of this treatment? What are the negatives? And one of the negatives truly is we are treating what we know is there, but there are unknown unknowns. We may not know that there is something else there. And MRI can miss it, biopsy can miss it. And so these patients have to be prepared to be monitored like active surveillance. And even when I perform a focal treatment, those patients, and afterwards, I tell them you're going to need routine PSA blood testing. You're going to need MRIs, plus or minus routine biopsies. Because some men want treatment over active surveillance because they say, Doc, I can't do the biopsies. It's so uncomfortable. I don't want another biopsy. And so let me do this focal treatment. And I have to counsel them and say, you're going to still need biopsies after we do this treatment because we have to monitor you and we have to monitor the zone that we did treat and we have to monitor the areas that we did not treat. But when patients really get peace of mind, there's a burden for men on active surveillance. Not all men have this, but the burden is, for example, you know, people know when they do their research. Metastatic prostate cancer can have spinal mets. And there's someone who has low risk prostate cancer or small volume intermediate risk prostate cancer, and they are outside shoveling the snow and then their back hurts. And they think, oh my God, my cancer is in the bone. You know, that level of anxiety in some patients is a reason to maybe consider treatment. And focal therapy can kind of balance treating them. Not just the patient's cancer, but treating also their psychology. But we'll keep them on active surveillance to make sure nothing kind of comes up in the areas that we don't treat. So that's kind of an ideal patient who may have lower risk disease, but by treating them with focal treatment, we're minimizing the side effects, but helping their psychology or sometimes their family psychology, their daughters, their spouses. They may be very concerned about them. You know, this is cancer. How can you watch it? And education's important. And even when you educate someone about genomics and how this is appropriate for surveillance, sometimes for some people, treatment gives them better peace of mind. And that's why it's a therapy that's important to offer.
So, you know, you talked about imaging. So, if I was going to ask you that, how often, say, if you're doing a surveillance PSA went over 20, do you incorporate a PSMA scan in there? Because it's kind of compatible with the MRI, but sometimes you may get more. Does that play a role?
It does. I mean, it unfortunately with PSMA becomes a payer situation where if our payer will support it, luckily most of these men may be Medicare if they're over 65, and Medicare hasn't had as many barriers to paying for these scans. But there are commercial payers who will have very strict criteria to pay for a PSMA. It's less strict of a criteria for MRI scans. But definitely, we utilize all the modalities that we can while we're monitoring. Leave no stone unturned. We want to make sure that we don't miss anything, especially when we're, monitoring or not giving whole gland treatment for someone. Our obligation as providers is to make sure that we, surveil them appropriately.
So, you are so quiet, you're so humble, but if somebody follows you that knows that your training comes from a very high pedigree, Georgetown, Cleveland Clinic. So as and now you are a part of a major independent urology practice, leading a leader among us. How has can you share a pivotal moment that shaped your clinical philosophy and where you are today with innovation and
Oh,
patient outcomes?
absolutely. Absolutely. I thank you for those kind words. I did train at some great facilities. Dr. John Lynch was head of Georgetown when I was there. It's now run by Keith Kowalczyk, who's a excellent prostate cancer specialist. We were able to rotate through the NIH, and I think the most impactful time for me was when I rotated there, and Peter Pinto, who still leads the focal therapy and the MRI innovations that have occurred throughout urology. All of it started at NIH, and seeing Dr. Pinto and his zeal for focal treatment, for preserving patient functional outcomes, just seeing how he approached what he did in a government job that sometimes didn't give him the resources that he needed or didn't appreciate the level of work he did, that was very humbling for me to see. And that was a kind of inspiration to see how can I take this with me and use it in my practice. And Dr. Pinto and Scott Eggener in Chicago was also a great pioneer, and they've trained and led the true current leaders in focal therapy, doctors George at Hopkins and Dr. Rastenhead in New York, and there's so many others who are kind of leading the academic front. Out in the private sector, we rely on the academic studies and their guidance to judge what we do in the clinics. And so I'm happy to, offer it to our patients at Chesapeake. But really, these academic leaders are paving the way by, it's like the lighthouse, giving us guidance on a foggy sea. We kind of see what direction to go based on, what they've researched and the guidance they give. So,
So let's talk about APPs. I know you work with quite a few of us. So, as we know, that there is a shortage in medical and providers. And again, an APP is never a substitute for a board-certified urologist, but there are functions where APPs can go at the top of their licensure and then help the service line, help the community, subspecialize. What are your thoughts? What do you see?
Yeah, no, we're fortunate in our practice to work with great APPs, and they're extremely critical, all aspects of medicine. But to focus to urology, often we're seeing the APP role increasingly be the gatekeeper. And in some practices, the urologist may be more focused with their procedural treatments, the biopsies or the focal treatments or the prostatectomies, what have you. It's the role of the APP to be the gatekeeper, the PSA gatekeeper, properly screening these men. And that doesn't mean generating prostate biopsies, but properly screening and counseling these men who maybe they do need a biopsy, maybe they need advanced imaging. I know that from recent news, President Biden was diagnosed with prostate cancer, and we saw a rush of patients coming in concerned about prostate cancer because of the news story. And I think APPs will be that front kind of gatekeeper to counsel these men appropriately. And then when you look at men who ultimately need treatment for prostate cancer, whether they're on surveillance or active surveillance or monitoring for recurrence of cancer, again, the role of the APP is there to properly counsel and guide those men through that standpoint. So I think we see an increasing role of APPs being kind of the gatekeepers, taking these patients throughout their journey because of the shortage of urologists. And it's great, being able to spend that level of time with the patient to properly counsel them is as important, if not more, than the actual treatment that we are giving as urologists. So it's a very important role, and I'm lucky to be, have experience with great APPs.
So, do you see that as we are evolving in healthcare, because there's different sectors, like you said, academic sectors, independent practice, private equity, and the GU cancer, I think at some point was very scattered, but now it's kind of getting a little bit more shape with advancement in bladder cancer, renal
Right.
cancer. Some therapies are going across. Do you see APPs getting more into that subspecialized role and kind of
Yeah.
gearing that phase and giving that continuity of care like a holistically? Because as you know,
Sure.
prostate cancer is sexual health, mental health, bone health.
Absolutely.
Do you know it's a lot of things. Again, cardiovascular health, which we sometimes don't even talk about because
Correct.
the low T. So if I go that route, how do you see this evolving?
Yeah, I think, in men's health, prostate cancer specifically, there's a lot of correlation to breast cancer in women. And breast cancer is light years ahead because of the technology, the genomics, the imaging that they've had. But the time with prostate cancer is now, and with bladder cancer, et cetera, because it feels like we're finally catching up, or we have the tools to properly diagnose and provide this precision medicine. And then the sheer amount of data for that we have now, let's say, for example, for an advanced prostate cancer patient, it's not just their cancer burden and what their treatment is. It's all the secondary effects, the effects of their androgen deprivation, the cardiovascular risks, their genetic risk for their children. All these things have to be discussed with them. And just some history with Chesapeake, we had tried it with just the urologist and we failed miserably. It's just that level of data and management, so many things slipped through the cracks. And until we involved our APPs who were able to do this in a very algorithmic way, spending the extra time with patients, we weren't really serving that population that well. So I only think that the amount of data that we have for each of these patients, prostate, bladder, et cetera, it's only going to get more and more. And I think the APP's role is critical to help us and help the patients truly get focused attention in each subset of that care that they need so that head to toe that they're doing better. So you bring up a lot of great points. I think it's just a evolving role, but a very important role. And it takes extra communication, it takes extra time, but these are things that APPs really excel at and are able to do a great job. So
Thank you. When you mentioned the word gatekeeper, microhematuria came to my mind, just popped in because, bladder cancer is the sixth largest cancer now in the US. But again, we get so many microhematuria consults to evaluate the risk stratification that has now changed and having new, like if patient does not need a cystoscopy,
Yes.
that screening becomes so vital for patients' information, knowledge, and all that stuff. I think that's and I do want to know what are your thoughts on not diagnostic, but interventional cystoscopies for APPs or even some biopsies for APPs?
Yeah, I think that's multiple roles here, and a couple comments here. We all take an oath, do no harm. And I think that proper screening, you brought up for microhematuria, there's a lot of harm with the cystoscopy. If you have like a 30-year-old male who's afraid on the table, the guidelines, that guy doesn't need a cystoscopy. And I think we're learning that. And there is a shortage of urologists. Access to proper care is getting harder and harder. And this is in even well-populated areas. If you look in the rural areas of our country, it's that much more challenging. So you had mentioned this comment earlier, APPs practicing to the level of their training and level of their certification and beyond. I think skills like cystoscopy and prostate biopsy and many office-based procedures, vasectomies, can be performed by the APPs. And I think the AUA has done a great job to have training for the APPs in this realm. And I support it because I think not only will it help with the access, but it also help with APP satisfaction. Job satisfaction is important. And to diagnose someone with a hematuria and then be able to do the cystoscopy and find a bladder tumor and get that patient onto resection and do it quickly, because the APP has the skill to do that, nothing beats it. So I think that's there needs to be more of a involvement of APPs and training to their level of certification and beyond.
Now, and I have to say this because I personally know you and I know how much you support us and how much you encourage us and to do. That's really appreciated because just like, true knowledge is more in giving. So
Yes.
teaching us gives us that satisfaction. I have to say that. So as we come towards the end of this, I would like to ask you about innovations in prostate cancer, right? Imaging, we know, have changed how we treat patients because CT bone scan to PSMA, significant change.
Absolutely.
But what I think is now, oncology drugs from breast cancer are coming into this space. Lung cancer are coming into this space. I mean, I don't know why we call it still a genetic testing. We should be calling genomic testing because it's just a new gene popping up
That's
somewhere
it.
else.
Yes.
How do you see AI genomic testing and also imaging in the next 5 to 10 years resonating with cancer and GU space?
Yeah, no, I recently read an article about, and this is bladder cancer, but there was AI pathologic tools that are looking at our pathology specimens, and they can predict which treatments would work the best for that patient based on predictive models and machine learning. And instead of this patient getting BCG and failing, they could predict that the patient would respond to gemcitabine docetaxel with a 90% success rate. So that patient should be steered to that treatment first. And I think we're at the brink of or an inflection point where precision medicine based on these AI tools, there's a huge potential. And it could be where a prostate cancer patient may say, wow, based on this AI tool, well, you need to have radiation. Or you don't have you need to get radiation because of some predictive methodology, and that will really help guide and steer patients to the right outcome. Despite our best efforts, there's still a lot of GU malignant deaths, and we can see that level drop significantly by utilizing these tools. And it'll take time and validation, and there's a question of who's going to pay for these tests. But ultimately, if it's truly going to help with outcomes, I think our founder at Chesapeake Urology, Sandy Siegel, had always quoted, I think Someone at Merck had said this, that if you focus on the patients, the profits will come later.
Yes.
So I think in all of medicine, if we focus on the patients and what's best for them, and the rest of it will sort itself out. So I do think that these tools will be revolutionary, and I'm eager to see how our practice changes as they evolve. Hopefully it's sooner rather than later.
I agree. I think doing the right thing when nobody's watching is the best practice that we should incorporate.
Yes.
So, Dr. Vora, appreciate you joining and look forward to learning from you and growing with you.
Absolutely. Same here.